This is Stories from General Conference on the Mormon Channel. The topic of this episode focuses on teaching. The importance of teaching cannot be overemphasized. Teaching in the church is a fundamental principle of the gospel. Each parent, son, daughter, husband, wife, brother, sister, church leader, classroom teacher, home teacher, visiting teacher, co-worker, neighbor, or friend has opportunities to teach. The following stories from General Conference illustrate a variety of examples about the influence of being teachers ourselves and being influenced by others as teachers. We begin with a story that Elder L. Tom Perry shared in the April 1999 General Conference about the first Sunday school in the Salt Lake Valley.
It was on Sunday morning, December 9th, 1849, at 8 o'clock, about 30 children arrived in a small classroom that had been built in a home. They stamped their feet on the threshold, took the snow off their coats and hats, and then took their places on simple benches. They waited expectantly for the class to begin. It was a cold and snowy day outside, but the fireplace radiated a warmth and friendly glow. Richard Ballantyne's eyes shone brightly as he called the Sunday school to order. He led the boys and girls in a song and then gave a quiet but fervent prayer, dedicating this room to the teaching of the children, the gospel of Jesus Christ. His voice was rich. His words rolled forth as words under a spell of reverence and emotion. Thus we have the founding of the Sunday school in the Salt Lake Valley. Organizing the Sunday school was not foreign to him. In his native Scotland, he had organized a Sunday school in the Relief Presbyterian Church, of which he was an active member. It was natural for him to have a great desire to educate young people in a knowledge of the gospel. He had been reared in a home where his father was fond of repeating from memory whole chapters of the Bible, then reciting them to his children. It was in a home where they would not even take a sip of water without first taking off their hats and saying grace, as was the custom also as they would begin each meal. Rumors were spread around the Scottish home of a new prophet being raised up in America. At first, Richard paid little attention to these rumors, but as his religious questions became more perplexing, he openly sought further light and knowledge. It was in 1841 that Elder Orson Pratt appeared in Edinburgh. Richard listened to his message and investigated the church for a year. He was baptized in the North Sea. He said, "I was so convinced that Joseph Smith was a prophet and the Book of Mormon was the Word of God. If I did not accept it, I would be damned." As was the case in many of the early converts of the church, he sold his business and immigrated to America, taking with him his mother and some of his brothers and sisters. They arrived in Nauvoo on November 11th of 1843, at a time when there was great turmoil in the city. They eventually left Illinois and made their way to winter quarters, where he married and soon prepared for the long journey west. They arrived in the Salt Lake Valley in September of 1848 and immediately commenced to build a home. It was in this home that the first Sunday school in the valley was held. When the chapel, the old 17th ward, was completed, the Sunday school was moved to the new meeting house. Brother Ballantyne had a fervent desire to teach young people the gospel of our Lord and Savior throughout his entire life. Thanks be to the late Conway Ballantyne Sawney, a cousin of mine, for this history of the first Sunday school. As we commemorate the celebration of the 150th anniversary of the founding of the Sunday school, it should be a time of reawakening within each of us our responsibilities to be good teachers. Nearly all of our associations and relationships involve the process of teaching. One of the major responsibilities of parents is to teach their children. Many of our assignments in the world of work involve being a good teacher. Every assignment we receive in the church requires some form of teaching.
Examples and analogies are effective teaching methods. Listen to this story told by Elder R. Conrad Schultz in the April 2002 General Conference and the resulting lesson made easy to remember for our own use.
In this world in which we live, things are not always what they appear to be. We sometimes are unaware of the powerful forces pulling on us. Appearances can be very deceptive. A few years ago, I had an experience with deceptive appearances where the results could have been tragic. My wife's cousin and family were visiting us from Utah. It was a calm summer day on the Oregon coast, and we were fishing in the ocean. It was pleasant. We were having a good time catching salmon. When for some reason, I turned around to see a huge 8-foot wave bearing down upon us. I only had time to shout a warning before the wave hit us broadside. Somehow, the boat stayed upright, but Gary, our cousin, was thrown overboard. We were all wearing life jackets, and with some difficulty maneuvered the boat, half filled with water, to where he was floating and pulled him aboard. We had been hit by what is called a sneaker wave. It doesn't happen often, and there is no way to predict an occurrence. Later, we found that up and down the Oregon-Washington coast, 5 people had drowned that day in 3 separate boating accidents. All were caused by the same sneaker wave, which for no apparent reason had welled up off the ocean surface. At the time we went out over the bar, the ocean was flat and calm and gave no sign of any danger. But the ocean turned out to be very deceptive and not at all what it appeared to be. As we make our way through this life's journey, we must continually be on guard and watch for those things which are deceptive and not what they appear to be. If we are not careful, the sneaker waves in life can be as deadly as those in the ocean. I am grateful that we had on our life jackets that summer day on the ocean. I'm thankful we were able to avoid the tragedy that came to others from that sneaker wave. It is my prayer that we will continue to wear our life jackets of obedience in order to avoid the tragedy that will surely come if we are deceived and follow the enticings of the adversary.
Following is another effective example of teaching, where we learn to watch for unseen dangers and that things are not always as they appear. The following excerpt was provided by President James E. Faust in the April 2002 priesthood session of General Conference.
One of the great myths in life is when men think they are invincible. Too many think that they are men of steel, strong enough to withstand any temptation. They delude themselves into thinking, it cannot happen to me. Borrowing a thought from Bertrand Russell, we are all like the turkey who wakes up Thanksgiving morning expecting lunch as usual. Things can go wrong at any time. Brethren, it can happen to any of us at any time. So much of our course in life is influenced by forces we only partly perceive. President Charles W. Penrose used to tell the story of an officer on the Titanic who stated that there was no fear of God, man, or devil because the Titanic was built so solidly it could readily withstand collisions with other ships or contact with any other force, including icebergs. The Titanic was, in fact, 3 football fields in length, 12 stories high, and built of the finest steel. On that fateful night of April 14, 1912, other ships warned of ice ahead. Yet the Titanic continued to increase her speed, cutting through the cold Atlantic Ocean. By the time the lookout sighted the iceberg, it was too late. The Titanic could not turn out of its way in time, and the iceberg scraped along the starboard side of the ship, creating a series of punctures. 2 hours and 40 minutes later, the brand new Titanic sank to the bottom of the ocean. over 1,500 people were drowned. Usually 1/8 of an iceberg is above the waterline. The ice in the cold core is very compact, and it keeps 7/8 of the iceberg under the water. As it was when the Titanic encountered the iceberg, so it is with us. We can often only see part of the danger that lies ahead.
You're listening to Stories from General Conference on the topic of teaching here on the Mormon Channel. During the October 2007 General Conference, Brother Daniel K. Judd, first counselor in the General Sunday School presidency, drew from his own experience as he taught teachers and leaders of the church how to become more effective in their assignments.
As a young man, I worked with my father and brothers raising cattle and horses on a ranch in southern Utah and northern Arizona. My father taught us that when we wanted to catch one of our horses to ride, all we had to do was to put a handful of grain into a bucket and shake it for several seconds. It didn't matter if the horses were in a corral or a large field, they would come on the run to eat the grain. We could then gently slip a bridle over their heads while they were eating. I was amazed that such a simple process seemed to always work so well. But on some occasions, when we didn't want to take the time to get the grain from the barn, we would put dirt in the bucket and shake it, attempting to trick the horses into thinking that we had grain for them to eat. When they discovered our deception, some of the horses stayed, but others would run away and be nearly impossible to catch. It often takes several days to regain their trust. We learned that taking the time to consistently feed our horses grain made them much easier to work with and provided them with increased nourishment and greater strength. Even though many years have passed since my days on the ranch, the experience I've just described has helped me as I considered the following question. What can we, as teachers and leaders in the church, do to provide increased doctrinal and spiritual nourishment for those we serve?
Personal experiences from our own life become an effective way to teach a principle. In the following experience from his boyhood, President Boyd K. Packer used this technique to teach about avoiding places of danger. This was from his address given at the April 2004 General Conference.
When I was a boy, childhood diseases appeared regularly in every community. When someone had chicken pox or measles or mumps, the health officer would visit the home and place a quarantine sign on the porch or in the window to warn everyone to stay away. In a large family like ours, those diseases would visit by relay, one child getting it from another, so the sign might stay up for weeks. We could not blockade ourselves inside our homes or stay hidden away to avoid those terrible contagions. We had to go to school, to employment, to church, to life. Two of my sisters were stricken with very severe cases of measles. At first, they seemed to recover. A few weeks later, Mother glanced out of a window and saw Adele leaning against a swing. She was the younger of the two. She was faint and weak with fever. It was rheumatic fever. It came as a complication from measles. The other sister also had the fever. There was little could be done. In spite of all the prayers of my parents, Adele died. She was 8 years old. While Nona, 2 years older, recovered, she had fragile health for most of her life. When I was in the seventh grade in a health class, a teacher read an article. A mother learned that the neighbor children had chicken pox. She faced the probability that her children would have it as well, perhaps one at a time. She determined to get it over with, all at once. So she sent her children to the neighbors to play with their children, to let them be exposed, and then she'd be done with it. Imagine her horror when the doctor finally came and announced it was not chicken pox the children had, it was smallpox. The best thing to do then, and what we must do now, is avoid places where there's danger of physical or spiritual contagion.
In an experience related in the April 2000 General Conference, Sister Colleen K. Menlove, primary general president, explained that all can be teachers. Even children have valuable lessons to teach us if we allow it.
A few months ago, I had an opportunity to take a morning walk on a mountain trail with four of my grandchildren. We each brought a small bag so that we could collect treasures from nature. As we looked for pieces to put in our collection, we found many different colors, designs, and textures in the leaves and the rocks. It was hard to choose. I soon noticed, though, that the children's bags were filling up. Each leaf that the children selected was unique, but because it was late fall, most of the leaves had dark, weathered spots, irregular shapes, or faded and discolored parts. Because of this, I was reluctant to add things to my bag. I was looking for the leaf that showed the brightest colors and had no flaws. If it wasn't perfect, I wasn't going to treasure it. But this meant that my bag had very little in it. Later, as I thought about this experience, I realized that I had cheated myself of much delight and happiness that could have been mine. I didn't appreciate the uniqueness of the objects because I was looking for what I deemed perfection. My grandchildren had been wiser than I had been. They had savored the odd shapes and spots on the leaves. They giggled at and enjoyed the brittle crispness of the drying leaves. And they delighted in the soft, faded colors. They filled their bags with happy treasures to take home. We can fail to see and enjoy the unique happiness and beauty in each day if we are so focused on our desire for what we want instead of what the Lord has designed for us.
We are both teachers and are taught by others. Learned well, lessons learned from others become very valuable in our own lives. In the October 1999 General Conference, President Boyd K. Packer related several dramatic accounts stemming from his experience in World War II that served him well then and remains good advice for us today. Listen as he teaches us the power of a hymn.
My brother, Colonel Leon C. Packer, was stationed at the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. A much decorated B-24 pilot, he became a brigadier general in the Air Force. While I was at Langley Field, the war in Europe ended, and so we were ordered to the Pacific. I spent a few days with Leon in Washington before shipping out for combat. He told me of things he had learned under fire. He flew from North Africa to the Ploiești oil fields in Romania. Very few of those planes returned. On April the 16th, 1943, he was captain of a B-24 bomber returning to England after a raid in Europe. His plane, the Yardbird, was heavily damaged by flak and dropped out of formation. Then they were alone and came under heavy attack from fighters. His one-page account of that experience says, number three engine was smoking and the prop ran away. Number four fuel line was shot out. Right aileron cables and stabilizer cables were shot out. Rudders partially locked. Radio shot out. Extremely large holes in the right wing. Flap shot out. Entire rear part of the fuselage filled with holes. Hydraulic system shot out. Tail turret out. A history of the 8th Air Force, published just 2 years ago, gives a detailed account of that flight written by one of the crew. With one engine on fire, the other three lost power. They were going down. The alarm bell ordered that they bail out. The bombardier, the only one able to get out, parachuted into the English Channel. The pilots left their seats and made their way toward the bomb bay to bail out. Suddenly, Leon heard an engine cough and sputter. He quickly climbed back to his seat and coaxed enough power to the engines to reach the coast of England. Then the engines failed and they crashed. The landing gear was shorn off on the brow of the hill. The plane plowed through trees and crumbled. Dirt filled the fuselage. Amazingly, though some were terribly wounded, all aboard survived. The bombardier was lost, but he probably saved the lives of the other nine. When smoke poured from the engines and a parachute appeared, the fighters stopped their attack. That was not the only time Leon had crash-landed. As we visited, he told me how he was able to hold himself together under fire. He said, "I have a favorite hymn," and he named it. "And when things got rough, I would sing it silently to myself. And there came a faith and an assurance that kept me on course." He sent me off to combat with that lesson. In the spring of 1945, I was able to test that lesson Leon had taught me those months before. The war in the Pacific ended before we reached the Philippines, and we were ordered to Japan. One day, we flew out of Atsugi Airfield near Yokohama in a B-17 bomber bound for Guam to pick up a beacon light. After 9 hours in the air, we let down through the clouds to find ourselves hopelessly lost. Our radio was out. We were, as it turned out, in a typhoon. Flying just above the ocean, we began a search pattern. In that desperate situation, I remembered the words of my brother. "I learned that you can pray and even sing without making a sound." After some time, we pulled up over a line of rocks jutting out of the water. Could they be part of the chain of the Mariana Islands? We followed them. Soon Tinian Island loomed ahead, and we landed with literally seconds of fuel in the tank. As we headed down the runway, the engines one by one stopped. I learned that both prayer and music can be very silent and very personal. Now, while that experience was dramatic, the greater value of Leon's lesson came later in everyday life, when I faced the same temptation you young people and children face now. As the years passed, I found that, while not easy, I could control my thoughts if I made a place for them to go. You can replace thoughts of temptation, anger, disappointment, or fear with better thoughts, with music. I love the sacred music of the church. The hymns of the Restoration carry an inspiration and a protection.
We can all learn from others. Someone once said, "Everyone is my superior because there is something I can learn from them." May we be good students and in turn good teachers to effectively pass on what we have learned to bless the lives of others. This has been Stories from General Conference on the topic of teaching. You are listening to The Mormon Channel. To learn more about The Mormon Channel, go to radio.lds.org.